Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We've got a great hour coming up for you. SDPB's Chris Loffrey will sit down with Jason Reitmeier. He's the wrestling coach at Augustana University, the winningest coach they've had in wrestling ever. You'll get to hear their conversation in a little bit. Later in the hour, we're going to feature a filmmaker for Independent Lens, which airs tonight, and that film is called Accidental Courtesy. It's a fascinating story about a musician, a black musician, who has decided over his the last several decades of life to reach out to members of the Ku Klux Klan and sit down with them, have a little coffee, listen to how they feel, eventually kind of change their ideology, and then they turn over his robes to him. It's later in the hour. We'll talk about that. But first, we're going to begin today's program with big changes on the music festival circuit. Lifelight, one of the world's largest Christian music festivals, will no longer be held annually on a farm near Worthing. Alan Green, founder and CEO of Lifelight Communications Incorporated, is with us today. He's here to talk about what's ahead for the music and the ministry. Alan Green, welcome to In the Moment.
Hey, glad to be here.
A whole new season for you. Big changes ahead. How's it feel?
It is a new season. We're pretty excited. You know, for 19 years, this is actually our 20th year in doing, would have been the 20th year in doing the festival. You know, it started out 3 years on a church lawn and then 4 years in the city at the fairgrounds, you know, 5 years west of town. And now for the most recent 7 years, we've been on a farm 12 miles south of Sioux Falls.
Were you there at the beginning, that first lawn concert there?
Yes. You know, my wife and I started the festival ministry, and it really started out of us taking our family on a missions trip to Juarez, Mexico, back in 1998. And out of that trip, you know, I was a business guy at the time and would have called myself a Christian, but God really broke my pride, broke my heart for the most needy among us. And we came back. We felt like we heard this kind of this thought, this word. We felt like we had a calling to take the church outside the walls. And so then part of that was to continue doing mission trips. But part of it was, you know, how do we reach our own city and our own community? And, you know, God had reached us through music many years earlier. So we launched a festival on a church lawn. And we have, you know, experienced over the years phenomenal growth with that. Thousands have changed lives. Many memories and traditions for people there. So I know that a lot of people are, you know, they're disappointed and a lot of the tears on Facebook. And so we're giving folks a little time to grieve. But we are telling them that it's not the end. It's just a change. There's something new.
It takes courage to make that kind of change. How are you sort of, you know, come to that conclusion that you were ready to stand in that moment and take the next step?
Well, I would say the last 2 years, God's been working on our heart. And I'll tell you, one of the turning points was earlier this year, I was in Washington, D.C. at a conference, and there was the Together event there, some friends of ours from Minneapolis, Nick Hall and Pulse, putting that on. And as we watched people there in D.C., we had been part of what they called serving the city and helping people in the city that had been going on, you know, months before that. And one of the guys stood up from stage at our conference, and he said, "Oh, I know you guys that, you know, you're great at the good news of Jesus, which is what our call is." But he said, "I would submit to you that it's the gospel and feeding the hungry, taking care of the poor, bringing awareness to human trafficking, fill in the blank. As followers of Jesus, that's not only our call, but it's the command for the church to be the church." So we felt like, okay, the festival has been great, but we need to change the model a bit. And so as we come back to Sioux Falls, really our heart is to love on the city, maybe use Sioux Falls this year as a missional opportunity for many groups around the region. And maybe there's groups that want to come, and we're launching what we call 60 Days to Unite a City this summer, and that would include service projects. So they can sign up for a project, bring a group, and take care of any sort of group of needs.
So tell me what else happens next then, because you obviously have some experience now doing some very large things. You can turn that experience and what you've learned and that passion into this new direction. Lay that map out for me a little bit. What does Lifelight, or what are we calling it now?
Well, it's Serve the City,
ServeSiouxFalls.com.
Okay. Serve the City. So ServeSiouxFalls.com is the website that's now up, and people can go there. they'll notice it'll be changing rapidly in that there will be a number of ministries involved. So our desire is to collaborate better, meaning we would involve those in the nonprofit world as well as those in the faith community and churches to identify the needs of the city. And so starting July 4th through September 4th, we will officially launch 60 days of service and start plugging those folks in, plugging groups into where they can help be the most help. And then at the end of that, and maybe even during that, we'll have some concerts and some celebrations. Our desire is at the end of that to have some sort of a festival, whether it's a day and a half celebration or, again, a festival that would include booths for maybe job fair, as we invite what I'm calling our guests of honors to the festival, which would be those that, again, we're trying to reach, the homeless and so forth. They would be given choices of here's food, here's free haircuts, here's free dental, medical, and here is someone who can help you in whatever you're struggling with. So it would become not just a handout, but maybe a hand up.
What are the needs of a city like Sioux Falls, as you have been able to ascertain so far?
You know, I think those organizations that are serving here in town already would say the needs are great. Example is, I just met with the superintendent of schools here a couple of weeks ago, and he echoed what had already been in the news, that they've identified, I believe it was over 800 public school children who would be called homeless. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as we look at a city like Sioux Falls, I think we who live here can sometimes be a bit prideful because we're like, yeah, it's exciting. People are moving here. There's 4,000 people per year moving to this city. It's a good thing going. However, in all those people moving here, there's great diversity and great need. And so I think that as we mobilize the faith community, we feel like that's the call, is to reach out to the least of these.
Has that collaboration existed in the past in a different way?
We've had great collaboration, I think, for the festival, although we've seen that come and go over the years. I think our desire is that we would drop our names. This really is not about Lifelight. That's why we're calling it City Fest, City Serve, City Fest. And we're collaborating already with two other ministries. One of those is Volunteers of America, who is a partner in this, and the other one is Empower, which Pastor Rich here in town has already, for the last 2 years, been trying to mobilize folks for these acts of service.
What have you learned through the building of Lifelight and through watching those traditions that you mentioned and the success of that? The groups that you brought in from all over the world, what did you sort of learn during that process that you think you can now pivot and apply towards serving the city of Sioux Falls?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we've learned. One, the whole success of the Lifelight Festival, I think when people look, especially from other areas around the country, and they say, how does that happen? Mm-hmm. How does the largest festival in the country end up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? And I think there's two keys. One, well, we feel it's been a move of God over the years. It's been beyond what we ever could have dreamed or imagined. But also, I think it's been because of the unity and the collaboration of those in the faith community. It's been kind of a grassroots thing. So, our desire is, with this fresh new vision, that we would see a new collaboration, a new partnership with folks that maybe the festival has kind of come and gone for them, and yet, for something new like this, loving our city. In fact, this model, one of the things we've learned, my son-in-law is on tour right now with what we call the Z8 Tour, Generation Z, and he's been all over the region. And as he's gone into a city, it's been more than just a concert. They've gone to those cities for at least 2 days. So they go there, they mobilize the young people, they mobilize the pastors and the business community. They go into the school the next day, and then the next evening they have the concert. So on a larger scale, the festival is going to be a bit like that. We really want to do a better job of mobilizing the faith community to serve, in addition to proclaiming, the good news of Jesus.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Alan Green. He's the founder and CEO of Lifelight Communications. As they sort of pivot their mission, you can find their new work at servesiouxfalls.com. Alan, I'm wondering what, in your experience, works in mission work and what doesn't?
Okay, well, that's a fun question for me, because last year I was in seven countries, and I've been a part of many missions organizations, and in some of those countries, been a part of a festival as well as missions. I think that we have to be careful, number one, to not just go into the missions field to do something and then feel good about ourselves. What I mean by that is it's okay to go do a work project or work in an orphanage, but we always need to involve the indigenous people in those countries. The book has been out for a while, you know, Toxic Charity. And I think one of the examples in there is, okay, a big group went to Africa and they gave away a whole bunch of mosquito nets. Great idea, but if they would have talked to the local business community and the local churches, there's a guy that was selling mosquito nets and making his living from it. Hmm. Wouldn't it have been better if they would have worked with him or maybe paid him, bought the mosquito nets from him, and involved the local folks? That's first thing. The second thing is the success we have seen in missions and what God has used in missions to change our life, you know, here is that it's based on relationships. Everywhere we've gone, it's been both maybe a work project, but also the relationship of proclaiming the hope that's found in Jesus. I think anything else, you know, the government can hand out food, but the government or the United Nations or whoever it is, the Red Cross, if they're not actually in relationship with the people or proclaiming the words of Jesus, we feel like that's the church's role. So we always think that it needs to be twofold.
Do you see, are you getting feedback from folks who have been longtime Lifelight goers who are excited about, I mean, obviously you see the tears on Facebook, as you mentioned before, and people sort of readjusting their Labor Day expectations. But do you see people also getting engaged and energized into what's possible? Did the energy build enough to really turn and unleash it on mission work in Sioux Falls and serving a city?
I think it will. I think we need to give people time. The reason I was huffing and puffing when I got here is there was a band in my office, a musician who came. He's on this tour with us, and he said to me, you know, he said, we've played at Lifelight for I don't know how many years. We love the festival. But he said, we were so excited about this new direction for you, because he said one of the things as a band is we stand from stage in front of people. He said, have we created in some sense kind of a sense of entitlement? You know, it's like the festival has been free all these years and people come. And yet this isn't the reason we've discontinued, but certainly it played into it that to put on $1 million festival each year, and yet the offerings really don't even pay for the porta potties, let alone the festival. Part of that, we have to say, okay, it's time to not just call people to come and gather, but call them to come and serve. And I think this new model will be well received. We've had lots of positive affirmation, lots of great comments, especially from those that have been major supporters. Lifelight has really been funded by some major donors and some sponsors, and they have all said, hey, it was never all about just, it was never about getting our name in front of the public. It really was about helping with the ministry, and we think this new direction is great. On the other side, I do understand that for lots of people, this is emotional because it's been their tradition for many, many years. Their families have come, their kids and grandkids have come. And I was given some good advice. Some folks said, hey, Alan, you guys have had a little while to work through this. Hmm. Understand that people need some time to grieve. And so if they're angry, that just means that they really liked the festival. So that's okay. And we invite them to contact us directly with any of their questions or concerns.
And you would encourage them to think of some new traditions at this point that involves service as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So July 4th is when the 60 days sort of launches. Is that what I heard you say before?
Right.
Did I get that right?
July 4th through September 4th, you know, they can go to lifelight.org, but otherwise that website that we've created, servesiouxfalls.com, will have lots of information. We do hope to be announcing for the festival part of it some bands in a few weeks, but clearly, as large as the festival became, finding a location in the city is difficult for that. We'd
sure.
love to just take over the city, but I'm not sure the city's going to allow that to happen. So we'll see what we do.
What's the potential here, do you think? You know, you mentioned taking over the city. You could take over the city with mission work that's effective and involves families. And talk about that for a minute of where could this go?
Well, here's what I've seen. I've been a part of City Serve in numerous other cities around the nation. Portland, New York City, Phoenix, Little Rock, Arkansas, just to name a few. And most of those cities have said, well, all of those cities have said that the service part of the ministry has been incredibly positive for the city. And it's also launched a sustained movement. So our desire would be that this wouldn't just be 60 days. The 60 days is just to get something started and then the festival celebration. But then beyond that, into the next year and the coming years, it will create relationships with ministries and nonprofits that will continue to be purposed to reach out around us. You know, our ministry of Lifelight started because I took my family, my whole family, was three preteen daughters at the time, and my wife, and we went into Mexico and did missions work. So I do think that this whole opportunity in Sioux Falls would be a great opportunity for people to serve as business groups together, or as families together, or as church groups together, as a college group together, and look on that website and say, oh, there's a need there, or there's a volunteer need there, I can serve there. And I think that will be it'll be a great blessing for the city.
Alan Green, the website is servesiouxfalls.com. Check it out. Alan, thank you so much for being with us today. Good luck on your
thank
new
you.
Venture.
You bet.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Jason Reitmeier is the head wrestling coach at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. Reitmeier is now in his 14th season and has become the all-time winningest wrestling coach in the university's history. In the Moment, producer Chris Loffrey had this discussion with the coach. He starts by asking about the program's success.
Well, you know, there's a good tradition here of wrestling and academics and athletics, and I really think that's part of it. We're getting the type of student athletes that really take a lot of pride in not just the wrestling part of it, but the academic part of it, and they exceed all expectations, you know, in competition. You know, we've had several great coaches here that kind of built a tradition. I just kind of played off that and kept getting the same kind of kids that they were getting.
What kind of recruiting base do you have there?
Well, we, you know, if you look at our roster, it's mainly Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota. That's usually the Midwest area. We get a few North Dakota kids now and then. It's a little tougher getting them from up there for some reason. But we also have a couple California kids, a couple Kansas kids in Missouri. So it's really pretty, though, that Midwest area.
Can you compare the wrestling in the Northern Sun Intercollegiate Conference to that possibly in the old North Central Conference?
Well, you know, I mean, everybody wants to kind of compare that and say, well, you don't have SDSU, you don't have North Dakota State anymore and stuff. The thing is, though, we did gain some other schools. You know, Mary at the time was an NAIA school that had won like 10 national titles in a row, and then they come into our conference. Upper Iowa, also a Division III school that had won national titles in Division III, had multiple All-Americans and national champs. And teams like St. Cloud and Mankato and ourselves have kind of continued getting better and better. So I think the wrestling is at the same point as it was at the high of the NCC. And I know a lot of people will disagree with that, but if you look at the national tournaments the last 10 years, the NSIC are always the teams. There's 5 to 6 teams in the top 15, and there's usually the national champ coming out of our conference. St. Cloud's won it 2 years in a row now, so you can see how difficult and how tough it is.
If you had to say, Coach, who are your top wrestlers this year?
Right now, Errol Amel is our top guy. I mean, he's been leading the team, you know, in wins, pins, Tech Falls. He's nationally ranked. He's a national qualifier. And then you got to go to Michael Lohman, our heavyweight, who is also nationally ranked, national qualifier. He's been doing really well. Those two have kind of been leading the team as far as being most consistent. You know, our 33-pounder, Brandon Charbonneau, he's a senior. He's been doing quite well, and he's had a tough stretch the last couple of weeks, but he's a very good performer and very consistent for the most part.
Now, Coach, South Dakota State is ranked in the top 25 in Division I wrestling. Now, if you can, what has made that program so successful, and how does that success help the sport in our state of South Dakota?
Well, I think, first of all, it starts with Coach Bono. He came in there, he changed the atmosphere, the culture. Not that the culture was bad when Coach Lyles was there, but I think that transition period, some of the kids got lost there as far as not you know, not staying on track and thinking, well, we got 3 years or 2 years before we compete at a national title. And I think that that culture changed a little bit. And I think when Coach Bono came in, he said, no, this is how it's going to be done. We're gonna work hard. We're gonna be in the classroom doing the right things, and we're also going to do the right things in the community. And I think it started with him, and then after that, the recruiting. He started getting kids not just from South Dakota, not just from Minnesota. He got kids from all over the nation that are ranked in the top 20 at their weight classes their senior year, and that's huge when you bring in that kind of talent. And then add it to the intensity and the environment and the culture that he's brought in. It's really big for the program to just shoot up and take off. And then I think for South Dakota itself, it's great because you got a Division I program that's ranked in the top 20, and it just brings a lot of pride to the state. It makes wrestling a lot more visible, and you get a lot more kids starting to see that and wanting to compete and wrestle outside of just South Dakota, but at the national tournaments and things like that. So the wrestling is going to continue getting better and better.
Coach, what are some of the differences, if you will, between high school and college wrestling, for example, riding time and such?
Well, I think the first thing is the intensity and the physicality of it. You know, in high school, I think you get two, three kids at a weight that are more talented, but they're also more physical, and they bring a different style to the mat. And the rest of the kids just can't handle that. You know, in college, you get that at every single competition. You get that physicality, that intensity, the guys that want to be out on the mat competing all the time. You know, and that's the biggest difference, I think, to start with. The riding time, you know, it is what it is. You know, you get a point for riding a guy a minute, but in high school, you know, again, I don't think that it would be that big of a difference with the riding time if you added that to it and stuff. I think it's more of the mentality and the intensity that kids bring to the mat compared to high school.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. On the phone with me is Jason Reitmeier, the all-time winningest wrestling coach at Augustana University. Coach, how does high school and college wrestling compare to the styles done in the Olympics?
You know, again, you know, your freestyle is similar to folk style in that, you know, the point system maybe is a little bit different, but it's a lot of on your feet. There is some bottom and top wrestling there that you have to do. But Greco is a style that people most see as being way different than the folk style and stuff. You know, it's all upper body. There's no leg attacks. You know, and a lot of lifts from top bottom position where you're lifting guy up and trying to throw them. That's probably the biggest difference there as far as the Greco and folk style or high school collegiate wrestling goes. As far as freestyle though, I think there's a lot of similarities. There's a lot of offensive attacks on the legs. You know, you're finishing hard, you get points for back exposure, similar to high school wrestling or collegiate wrestling.
Two-part question. What makes a successful college wrestler, and what separates a Division II wrestler from, let's say, someone in Division I?
Well, I think dedication and discipline is probably one of the biggest things. I mean, wrestling, like any sport nowadays, it's not just seasonal. It's year-round. You're in the weight room, you know, 3 to 4 days a week all year round. You're on the mat, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 days a week, during the summer and fall and spring, and then 5 to 7 days a week during the season. So it's a lot of dedication and being on the mat, but it also there's a mentality to wrestling that makes you great. I don't know if it's the fear of losing or the gratitude of what you get when you win, but something's in the guy that just doesn't want to lose and puts everything out there and just leaves it all on the mat all the time. And that usually that makes a great wrestler who can come out and just leave it all out there and just no regrets. Doesn't come off the mat and go, well, I should have did this. No, you left it all out there and did what you had to do to either win or you made it very difficult for your opponent to get the W. as far as difference between high or Division II and Division I, you know, I think Division II has athletes that can compete at that level. I mean, we used to send our national champs, our runner-ups to the Division I national tournament, and they'd be placers and stuff. We've had several here at Augustana, in fact, with guys like Colin Knight and so forth. But I think the depth overall of Division I wrestling is a lot higher. You know, when you walk into a Division I room, you have 3 to 4 guys that all can compete at a very high level. Division II, we just don't have that same depth for many reasons. One is scholarship levels, you know, the academic standards that we have here and stuff. But at the same time, I think we have, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 guys that can compete at any level at any given day.
What's it like coaching at your alma mater? Is there any unusual pressure with that scenario?
No, I love it. You know, I was fortunate enough to be coached by Craig Pressler when I came here, and he you know, kind of brought me up the right way and kind of explained what was most important, which were our principles and things like that. You know, winning's winning, but if you're not doing it the right way with the right kind of kids and stuff, it really doesn't mean a whole lot. And I think our school understands that. I think our administration understands that. And it's just a different beast coaching at Augustana because of the academic standards, the kind of kids we have to bring in to be able to afford this kind of school. The academic and athletic has to be kind of similar, you know, as far as high GPAs, high ACTs, and then a high ability to compete at a high level.
That record was 154 wins, previously held by Coach Paul Kendall. You've surpassed that. You've become Augustana University's all-time winningest coach. Coach, humble me a little bit, and what do you attribute to your success there?
Well, first of all, I think it's the kids. You know, the kids have done the winning for us. You know, we father that and kind of, you know, put them out there and put them in the best situation we possibly can. But they're the guys that get it done and get the victories and stuff. And then, you know, administration has given me the resources to not only recruit these kids but have a great coaching staff. And the coaching staff, you know, puts together these game plans for these kids and gets them ready for the matches. And they've done a great job, Tom Meester and Chisholm Fink and Ryan Carlson and guys that I had in the past and stuff. And then, of course, you know, I believe my family puts up with a lot. And any coach knows that. Their families put up with a lot. And without them, I don't think I could put in the time and the effort that I do. They're very understanding. So, again, I think kids and the staff and the administration and my family have put me in a very good position to go out and get some victories.
He's Jason Reitmeier, head wrestling coach at Augustana University, not just the head wrestling coach, the all-time winningest wrestling coach in Augustana history. Coach Reitmeier, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Accidental courtesy is the portrait of a man who has spent a lifetime pursuing an answer to the question, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? The film follows Daryl Davis. He's a musician. He's a black man who befriends members of the Ku Klux Klan, sitting down with them, listening to their worldview, and sometimes walking by their side as they slowly change their ideology. Dozens of former Klansmen over the years have befriended Daryl and given them their robes as symbols of the changing of their minds and their lives. Accidental Courtesy airs tonight at 9 p.m. Central on SDPB-TV. Matt Ornstein is the film's director. He joins us now via phone from Los Angeles. Matt, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to start in an unexpected place, because let's talk about the soundtrack to this film.
Sure. I'm always happy to talk about that.
How fun is that? It's a great soundtrack throughout. Tell me why it was important for you to layer that sound in the way that you do.
Well, music's a huge part of Daryl's life, and it's often his first line of communication to some of these people in the film. They see him play, and they're captivated by that, and that's kind of his entry point. But then there's this other thing in the film, it's sort of like a thread through it and really deserves to be its own piece, but it's about pop music as the history of integration in America. You know, because you combine these classically black and white art forms and you get this thing that really changed the landscape. And so the music was always really important to us, and in the festival version of the film, we had a lot of songs that when we tried to actually license, it was just a staggering estimate. And so we got really lucky, and we already had some Charles Bradley songs in the movie. And the people at Daptone that do Charles and Sharon Jones, rest in peace, did our music, our score. And so the songs and the score kind of blend together, and I just love it so much. And yeah. Tom Brennick, if you're listening, really thank you again so much for everything.
And it gives the whole, it paints a whole picture of sort of hopefulness for me too. In a topic about race in America that wouldn't, you know, isn't, the conversations aren't always particularly hopeful, but then there is this soundtrack that sort of drives it to the next, the next location, the next conversation.
I totally agree with you, and it was important for us. You know, we don't want the film to be something that that is homework. It's like you had your whole day, and then you have to sit through this as well. We'd like it to ideally be an enjoyable experience, and I think the music is the light that carries us through some of the darker places.
Yeah, let's talk about Daryl as a musician.
Sure.
You see him playing this flaming piano in his younger days. Tell me what is he like?
I mean, Daryl's a larger-than-life character, yeah, clearly, as you could see from the movie, but he's also a tremendously patient man. And that's something that really was driven home to me through watching him work.
How did you get to know him and decide that you wanted to, follow his work?
I initially became aware of him through a newspaper article, and I was just sort of compelled by the uniqueness of his approach. I wanted to know why he did it, what he got out of it. I just had a lot of questions. And when I did finally manage to link up with him, I emailed him a few times. When we did link up, I was in New York, and I went down to D.C. to meet him, and he picked me up at the train station. And on the drive from there to his house, he started telling me some of the stories that would be the film. Hmm. And I knew by the time we hit the state line for Maryland that there was a film to be made here.
Yeah. He's a whopper of a storyteller. I mean, the man knows how to tell a story.
He's a raconteur.
That's right. Let's start with this story that he tells about being, and not to put you on the spot and make you recreate one of those dynamic stories owns and delivers so effectively. But he's a Cub Scout, and he's kind of, tell me a little bit about his background as a child, and then this moment at the Cub Scout parade in America that sort of changes how he sees himself.
So Daryl's raised abroad. His father is in the Foreign Service, and he's a diplomat. And Daryl's raised in this sort of utopian environment where there's kids of all different, you know, races and nationalities in a classroom, and they all get along, and then he comes back to America and is in school and is suddenly confronted with this reality that he hadn't had to previous to that. And the moment when it really crystallizes for him is when he's marching in a parade with his fellow Cub Scouts, and he starts getting things thrown at him, and then realizes they're only being thrown at him as the only Black Scout. And he goes home and asks his parents what's going on. Hmm. And that begins this journey that carries us up to now.
Yeah, there's this moment where his Cub Scout leaders surround him to sort of protect him, and they won't tell him the truth. He starts saying, you know, why is this just happening to me? And they just, hush now, you know, don't worry about it. You know, get him off the street. They're protecting him from not only the flying projectiles, but from the truth at this point.
And there's a fascinating metaphor in that, because Daryl's immediate response was he didn't want to be protected from the truth. He wanted to know not only what was going on, but why. He wanted to know why they did that, which I think is still, if I had to boil down his quest to a single question, that might still be it today.
Right, that curiosity. So then let's talk about the nuts and bolts of this thing. His life, and it's been going on for several years, is to reach out to members of the KKK and white separatist groups and say, let's have lunch. That takes a certain amount of guts.
It does, and as I often point out to people, this is also sort of his hobby. This is his leisure time activity. He's a working musician. He plays a ton of shows every year, and then, you know, in his spare time, he does this outreach.
Yeah.
And when he does it, it's very interesting, because he approaches them in such a way that his primary goal is to leave the door open for them to realize that they can change. So he's not accusational. He doesn't tell them what they do or necessarily what's wrong with them. I mean, he will if it comes up, but that's not his primary agenda. Mm. He's just trying to kind of open the door a crack.
What was it like for you to sort of hang out with him and sit? Because I'm guessing that you as a filmmaker had not sat down with this many, cameras pointed at a member of the KKK or a member of a white separatist group?
Certainly not. I mean, the journey you go on as a viewer kind of parallels our journey, because there were moments when we were repulsed, but there were also moments when we were genuinely laughing about their interactions, and you almost forget for a minute what you're dealing with.
Right.
It really runs the gamut, because they are, you know, you kind of see three different people. The three of the main clans people in there are good examples. There's Jeff Scoop, who's the guy who's a skinhead, who's like a prominent National Socialist leader, who's pretty hardcore. And there's Thomas Robb, the older one, who says some of the worst things in the movie, who's a famous Klan leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Frank Ancona, who's very affable and sort of seems on the verge of a change. And he, unfortunately, was found dead this weekend.
No.
Yeah, just like days ago. And it seems to be not Klan-related, but it just kind of shows the tumult of that world, I suppose.
Wow. Have you spoken to Daryl after that happened? Probably.
Daryl let us know that it had happened, and we, of course, you know, feel terrible for his family, but we don't have any more information than the public does yet.
Let's talk about him a little bit, because he's the gentleman who gives a certificate to Daryl, calling him a friend of the organization. And Daryl just asks these questions of him to sort of figure out, because all these men that you've described are motivated by slightly different reasons. Not all of, you know, some of them are trying to avoid what they call a white genocide.
Yeah.
Some of them are trying to create a separate state. Some of them are trying to do something else that I can't quite ascertain. But why are Daryl and Frank friends?
Well, Daryl and Frank's friendship really seemed to be genuine. This is a poor analogy, but for us, it sort of seemed like one of those things where there's friends or family members who love each other, and it's like, oh, we just don't talk about politics, ha-ha.
Right.
Sort of on that level, they really, you know, cared about what was going on in each other's lives, what was going on with their families, and they were making plans to do things, and that warmth is genuine. That's not something coerced by us. But then they disagree on this single fundamental looming issue.
Right.
And it really did seem to us that of all the people in the film, Frank might be one who did reconsider at some point. He seemed to have the most kind of overt humanity.
He seems the closest to that moment. But we should say, he also says, for America to survive, it needs to be under white Christian rule. He says he's an imperial wizard from the Traditionalist American Knights. Is that the TAK? Am I getting that name right?
No, he is from the TAK. He is known for some pretty reprehensible things.
Right. Not a Nazi, drawn because of the ritual and the mysteriousness and the intrigue of the organization. But yes, he says some pretty reprehensible things and puts those things in the world and asks other people to join along. So does Daryl just tell people like Frank what they want to hear? How does he sort of get them to listen to him?
I'm so sorry you cut out for 1 second.
Sorry. So, I mean, Daryl, when he sits down, how does he get these people to listen to him? I understand how he listens to them. How does he get them to sort of listen in return?
So Daryl's thing with them when he sits down is he really does hear them. Even if he's heard what they're saying many times before, or he knows he disagrees with it, he doesn't just like skip ahead to the part where he responds. He really hears them out.
Hmm.
And so because he does that, they do that for him. And obviously it's more complicated and more nuanced than that, but that was one of the first things that I noticed, because I'm guilty of the same thing as well. Once I already know I disagree with something, I'm sort of on autopilot a little bit.
And that's the patience thing that you spoke of earlier. He's an incredibly patient person. And then we see his patience fray just a little bit in a conversation with some activists, some younger folks from Black Lives Matter. And they sort of take him to task for not doing enough or not doing the right thing. Tell us a little bit about how Daryl's sort of hobby, if we can call it that, appears to some of the younger activists who are in the cities, marching and demonstrating on a daily basis.
That's a really fascinating scene, because you sort of see a generation gap highlighted that I was not as aware of between generations of activists. And, you know, Daryl comes into the scenario and he sees these younger activists who I think are really powerful voices we're going to be hearing a lot from. And Kwame, we've done some screenings with, and I think he's great. But, you know, he sees these people that, as far as he's concerned, stand on the shoulders of his generation's accomplishments, and they don't really give him the time of day. from the beginning, they're not really interested in what he is or what he has to say. And so he closes his heart to them. And that's not something we see him do in some of the other scenes.
Right.
So for us as filmmakers, it was surprising as well, but then sort of more understandable once we had time to watch it later and dissect it a bit.
What was he like after, what were all of you like? You all had to have been sort of shaken by that conversation, because they sort of turn on you as a group of filmmakers too and say, look at what you're doing here and reconsider it. What are the conversations in the room after that?
Well, certainly people were a little bit shaky. That was the first day of that particular unit of shooting, and we were off to the races. But for the core filmmakers, we knew that was a response that happened sometimes that Daryl had told us about. And in the interest of balance, we wanted to get some element of that at some point.
Hmm.
We didn't know it would be that day. We actually were there to shoot Michael Wood, the police officer turned activist. And Kwame and Tarek and JC kind of came out of that organically. So that day, it wasn't on my list or anything, but once it was happening in front of the cameras, we knew it was something that was going to be important.
How did you decide some of these places to go and visit with Daryl? You're looking for the etching at the Lincoln Memorial that shows the spot where Martin Luther King Jr. stood and gave his famous I Have a Dream speech,
right.
Trying to find that spot, which is surprisingly... poorly marked, I guess.
That was a surprise to me as well. For people that don't know exactly what we're talking about, where Martin Luther King gave the speech, there's a little etching in the ground that if you're looking for it, you can find it.
Right.
But if you weren't there specifically for that, you would never.
Uh-huh.
And it seems very, it seems like a glaring omission.
Right. You kind of come up there and he's going to show you where it is. You've never seen it. And there's some people just sort of standing on it, looking at their phones. They don't know.
If nothing else comes out of this movie, I certainly hope we get a better plaque there.
Right, I think so too. And then there's places like the Lorraine Motel as a museum, Ferguson, Nathan Bedford Forest, the Confederate Park visit. Give me an idea of this journey across the country, really, and across history.
At the end of the day, Daryl does what he does because he's curious about these things and he has his own reasons, but he also really loves this country and believes in democracy, and that's one of the things that really brought us, that united Daryl and my fellow filmmakers in the first place. And so we have some of these things that are examples of America at its best, or things to remind us of particularly strong moments or individuals, and then we have these landmarks that become landmarks out of tragedy. They're chosen for the wrong reasons, and those are equally important for us to remember.
You do a masterful job in the film, and if you're just tuning in, the film we're talking about is called Accidental Courtesy. It's on Independent Lens tonight. You can see it at 9 p.m. Central on SDPB-TV. That's 8 p.m. Mountain. We're talking with Matt Ornstein. He's the film's director. And one of the things you do particularly well is sort of juxtapose this footage of some of these people that Daryl sits and, has a cup of coffee with or has a conversation with. Some of them who seem, in that conversation, open-minded, more than you might think, and then you sort of flip it with this footage of the hate speech that they are spreading online and in person and the anger that they have. Jeff Scoop is a great example of that. Wants a white nation state. He's with the Nationalist Socialist Movement. They are really talking about Elvis Presley and whether or not he invented rock and roll there at the coffee shop. Tell us about that moment.
That's really interesting because that's the first time Daryl knew, they both knew who the other one was, but they had not met before. And so whereas some of the other relationships you see are things Daryl's been cultivating for a while, that one's interesting because you see him start from zero.
Mm.
They're sitting down, they're in a diner. They are very radically opposed on pretty much everything, and Daryl's looking for that common ground.
Right.
And eventually they find it.
But they don't agree on where rock and roll came from.
They don't agree on where rock and roll came from, but that's where, as filmmakers, it's nice because we have a sort of visual counterpoint of Elvis with some of the many black musicians who he not only copied from but also credited.
Right. Is there a sense of, some of these Klan's members who turn around and there has to be a cognitive dissonance between what they're saying, at their meetings and then sitting down with Daryl and saying, oh, but I like this guy.
I mean, the fact that they can compartmentalize like that is interesting. It sort of says to, it suggests to me that maybe they don't believe it as strongly as they think they do.
Yeah.
Because the best example is the guy who's not actually in the movie, but a former Klan's leader who they're asking him why he would go to Daryl's wedding.
Daryl's wife.
They ask why he'd go to Daryl's wedding if he's so opposed to interracial marriage. And he says, well, you know, I do it because it's Daryl. And that's not a very good answer.
Yeah.
If this is a belief, what he believes is wrong, but if he believes in it that strongly, you would think it would extend to even a situation involving Daryl.
Yeah.
But the force of personality overcomes it there, which I think shows to me that crack in their philosophy.
It's an intelligent film, occasionally disturbing and occasionally funny, but smart and very watchable and thought-provoking for certain. Matt Orenstein is the director of Accidental Courtesy. You can see it tonight on Independent Lens. That's at 9 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Mountain, SDPB Television. Matt, thank you so much for being with us here and sharing your film with us. We appreciate
it. It's a pleasure talking to you. It's always a real treat to do public radio, and I appreciate what you do very much.
We'll see you next time. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.